Lorraine Millard is my guest this week. Lorraine also works at the University of Kent. She has been a therapist since around 1984, and she talks about having a job which deals with authenticity and how great an honour that is. We talk about the evolution over the years of student support and making the leap from school to university. We talk around student debt and how some students will avoid other students. We talk about how Lorraine stumbled into her career. She studied literature, philosophy and drama in higher education. She fell into working with drama and education and talks about how you don't know what you want to do until you start the journey. She talks about, in Jungian terms, individuation and how that applies in each person, how we cultivate happiness. Lorraine talks about the joys of therapy and who would have supplied that role in the past before we had professional therapists. We talk about the importance of whether you are present for the other person in a counselling context. Lorraine talks about the importance of storytelling, something that was very important when she was young. We talk about our inherent worthiness and the difference between Buddhist and Christian understandings of sin and guilt, and the different conceptions of God, and the importance of the hero's journey, and how film is our modern-day storytelling. We talk about music and Ed Stewart and Motown and Gilbert O'Sullivan and reggae, and how Lorraine was very politically active. We talk about mindfulness and being driven by our thoughts, and how it is being taken seriously in universities. Lorraine talks about being a seeker and the importance of meditation and how mindfulness changed her life more than anything else and the communal aspect involved. We also learn why her go-to music is Indian chants. Lorraine's memories, we discover, are chiefly positive. She talks about why she has become more compassionate towards her younger self and whether she has achieved what she wanted to. She talks about when she did some work on aging and mindfulness some years ago and the importance of being as present as possible. And at the very end of the interview, we learn the things that make us feel alive are often the simplest. What an absolute honour it was this week for my latest nostalgia interview to interview Lorraine Millard. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a great pleasure to have Lorraine Millard today. We've known each other for, I'd say, about 4 or 5 years, because we both work at the university. And you have this, what I think is amazing about you is that you've got so many different things going on in counselling. You know, you seem to be somebody who's so very active, but also very people-oriented. So how long have you been at Kent?
I've been at Kent for 7 years. Well, I've been a therapist and a psychotherapist, and before that a drama therapist. Since I was very young, started in about 1984.
Yeah.
So, and I've always been drawn towards working with people. I'm really curious about them. I really like people.
Yeah. Well, I found, because I've just come to the end of my time as senior tutor, and what I always found is that when you see real people, you know, you can often have these stereotypes about students.
Yes.
The idea is, oh, they're not hardworking. Well, in many cases, they have jobs. You know, they may not be going to their lectures, not because they're lazy, but because they have jobs. And then you meet them, and you always sort of think, oh, this person's never come to any meetings, and you know, you sort of feel in advance that you can be really annoyed with them, or you feel that they're just a lost cause. But then you spend 10 minutes in their company, and you think, now I know a bit about your history, and actually, you've done. It's amazing that you're here at all.
Absolutely, absolutely. Sometimes I feel so honoured that I have the kind of job where we go towards authenticity.
Yeah.
And I think that's amazing that, you know, I can go straight in and talk about the more intimate details of somebody's life and where they don't have to pretend. And when that happens, that's amazing. And it just feels an honour that you see these individuals walking around, especially our young people. I have such awe, in some cases, for how they survive these days and carry on when I know about their histories.
And particularly when I was a student, we didn't have anything like the sort of student support network that we have now. And I always think one of two things, either students in those days didn't have the same, for example, mental illnesses as students today often have, and in which we support them to the hilt. Or it was just the case that, you know, we didn't have that they did have mental health issues, but they were not able to go to somebody who was able to support them.
Mm.
And I look back, and sometimes you think there were always occasional students who would get a little bit of, you know, maybe the departmental administrator, or there'd be a member of staff who would ad hoc, you know, give them an extra few weeks on a deadline, or maybe in some cases they would extend their period of study. But it felt very ad hoc, and it felt like, you know, that in a class of 30 students, one of them is clearly not performing well. Whereas these days, it is just so commonplace for a student with an inclusive learning plan to get all the support that they need.
Yeah.
Has that journey been similar for you? I know you haven't been in university the whole time, but the sense that today there are so many more opportunities for people to get the help, which a few years ago they just had to sort of get on with it themselves.
The jury's out for me, because I'm not sure whether we're aware of it more and people get more help, therefore we see more of it. I'm not sure if we're not helping young people to be robust enough to cope with things, and that they have almost a fear, some people, some young people, of feeling an emotion or feeling sad or knowing that's just part of being alive. And I think that's why I like the mindfulness so much, because it's actually saying this is what it means to be human, and these are some techniques that could help you to cope with that. And so that you can kind of keep up with the work and you can do a presentation. But on the other hand, they're pressurised at school. They have to pay a lot of money. It's a huge leap from being a bit closeted at school at times, because their tutors and their teachers want them to do well. And then coming into the anonymity of the university. And that in itself for some people is overwhelming, for some young people, I think.
And I've always thought that, we were just talking before we started recording as well, that, you know, I've been here 15 years.
Yes.
And it really has struck me that, you know, from the very beginning, that sense of, you know, because I was once a student and I knew what how important it was for a colleague, for a lecturer, to reach out and sometimes just say, you're doing okay, or, you know, just to sort of give a bit of encouragement sometimes if you pass them in the corridor or, you know, in a tutorial. And I think that probably was my incentive for going into this profession.
Yes.
There's a whole, you know, sometimes you think, of course, we have to write lots of books and we have to get grant applications and all those things are important.
Yes.
But sometimes you just think, you know, at heart, what is it that makes me get up in the morning and come into work?
Yes.
And I kind of feel that hasn't changed in 15 years, but the culture around me might have changed.
Yes.
As you say, students are now paying their fees.
Yes.
And so there are all sorts of issues around that. But is that something that you found particularly problematic, that, you know, because students are now paying their fees, all sorts of other concerns?
I think they're very worried about that. They're worried about, you know, that this debt could be around for a long time and that they have to do well.
Yeah.
I think there's such a kind of emphasis on, and it's so much more just about getting a grade rather than, university used to be about transformation, didn't it, to becoming an adult fully, and we just don't have time for those kind of bits. And I've had students say to me that the reason they like coming to counselling is, one of them said it's because they liked being around an older person, because so many young people around, but also because they said there's somebody in the university that notices if I don't turn up.
No, and that's very important, because I mean, it happened many years ago when I was in the University of Wales. A student went missing, and I think he was from the Middle East. He had no family over in Wales, and some months later, the police were sort of doing some investigating, you know, when it was clear that, you know, maybe they needed to go all the way back and sort of. And they asked the university, in the days when we didn't take registers, you know, what was the date when this student was last in class? And of course, nobody really knew, because if you don't keep a register, then nobody would know. And it was a sort of, you know, and remember the tutor saying, well, you could ask the other students, sort of thing. But these days we would know exactly if a student had been there or not been there, and we would have, you know, a record of that. And some students like that. They like the fact that we notice them. We get a few who, of course, occasionally will naturally say, it's a bit North Korea, isn't it? But at the end of the day, you know, yeah, you're paying a lot of money to come here, but also we have a duty of care. We're not just going to take your money. We have to follow that through.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, but sometimes it can feel that they're not noticed until they're in trouble. You know, that we noticed absences, but we don't always follow that up.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to get lost. You know, you'll hear about students that never come out of their room, or I hear about students that will come and that the whole interaction, especially in the first year, about having to be around people all the time. So they'll wait and cook at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And, you know, their whole system gets out.
Yeah, well, when nobody else is around, I've
when
heard
nobody
that.
Else is
they
around.
They wait for their friends to go out clubbing or an evening, and that's when they materialise and actually cook a meal that they haven't eaten for, the whole day.
Yeah. And then, of course, then they're asleep late in the morning, and then they get into that kind of, the cycle begins of missing lectures. Sort of disappearing a bit.
So, and I used to find that as senior tutor, that because you're dealing with students at that time, rather than necessarily when they're perhaps thriving, although I guess you hopefully, you know, see them when they do make that transformation, as often, of course, that's always the hope. But even as senior tutor, I'd have students coming to see me who were not attending classes, but then I'd be, in some cases, maybe the same students, but from a lecture point of view, dealing with students who would never miss a class.
Yes.
And if they ever missed a class, they'd write a note apologising. Yes. So I was dealing with these two very different extremes.
I think, you know, they are the over-conscientious ones and that are quite fearful about not attending everything that they're meant to.
And I think also, I think something you once said in a talk I heard you give, that it's often the students who are doing really well and thriving that, you know, just because they're getting great, you know, I think great A's, getting first class marks, doesn't mean to say that their lives are wonderful. They may be channeling everything into their studies.
Yes.
And we often just think, oh, if they're not attending classes, there must be problems. But often it's the students who are excelling that also need to be nurtured.
Absolutely. I was wondering, because I've worked around, particularly around abuse and trauma, and I worked with children and adults. And with the children, it will be often the ones that had quite severe trauma. It wasn't that they were acting out, it's that they dissociated into study. And since I've been here, I've met more and more of those young people that can keep going all the while they're going for an A or they're going for a first.
Yeah.
And it's in the third year when they start to crumble because they've dissociated all of their past or all of the trauma that might have happened to them into being this person, you know, who can do the best as a student.
Mm.
And when that A is no longer somewhere to go for, then they have to start looking at who they are.
Yeah. Yeah, and the number of students who will say that parental pressure is so strong that they know that if they don't get the degree classification that their parent wants them to get, then there could be consequences. It could be financial consequences.
Yes.
It could also just be a sense of failure.
Yes.
But I often will then say to the students who tell me this, did your father or mother, whoever, go to university themselves? And the answer is invariably no.
Yeah.
So I think that is often the problem, the assumption of what university is.
Yes.
But people
who've
been in the university know that that actually is a learning model is very counterproductive.
Yes.
But how did the journey start for you then? So obviously you've been doing this for many decades, but did you imagine at an earlier stage that this is something that you might want to do? Was this something from school or university?
No, I come from the kind of background where I didn't know what a counsellor or a therapist was.
Yeah.
I kind of stumbled into my career. I finished at what was then a polytechnic and went to studied English and drama and had been quite ill.
Yeah.
So I had, in my A-levels, not done that well because of illness, and then sort of thrived at university and was just so interested. I was really interested in everything.
And was it literature that you were studying?
Literature and philosophy.
Yeah.
And I did drama on the side.
Yeah.
And that was lovely. That was really useful. So I had all the part of going to the Edinburgh Festival and thinking, do I want to be an actress?
Yeah.
And realise it's quite boring doing the same thing over and over again. And I really couldn't take the criticism.
Yeah.
I just didn't have the backbone, I don't think, at that point, to take that. And then I fell into... I went abroad for a while and I fell into working with drama in education. When the ILE in London, ILE?
Oh, the Inner London
Education.
ILE.
We're giving us grants and money to go and do that. And then I started working in different groups of people and then I worked with a drama therapist.
Yeah.
So at 24, I suddenly thought, this is really interesting. I love doing this in groups.
It is funny, isn't it? Because you've got some students, even now, you know, who at the age of 18 know what they want to do, and they want to be a school teacher because they were influenced. But there was an A-level teacher who was particularly mesmerising, and they think, "I want to be you," and therefore they do the degree very strategically. But whether they end up following that path is another thing. And I always think the exciting thing is sometimes you know, not necessarily, you know, being open, being receptive to, you know, university is about learning. Hopefully you'll all come out the university not a different person, but actually somebody who's far more aware,
yes,
of who you are and who you can be and who you want to be. And it sounds like you found your way.
I stumbled across it.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't have known. And I'm always saying this to young people in the university, you know, you don't always know what's possible until you start walking the journey, and then doors sort of open.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can't possibly know at even 21 it is you might want to do.
No, it's funny because from a very young age, I always knew something on radio was... but also a lot of people were like, you know, how are you going to do that? But it sounded... You know, no one in my family had that sort of background. So it felt like a little bit sort of like, you know, you enjoy listening to the radio. I suppose some people, like, you know, it's like wanting to be an astronaut. You know, you see someone else doing it, but it doesn't mean to say that that's necessarily an opportunity that's available. It's more that, you know, other people do that who have a very particular, you know, it's a very niche area with lots of expensive training and support. And it's interesting, but some of that passion has never left me in decades, and it's never gone away. But there have been times when I've, you know, never even considered that might happen. But over the last year or two, suddenly I'm thinking, everything I'm doing, the way I'm disseminating myself, it's like that sort of childhood dream.
And yes.
I'm sure it's the impetus as well for these interviews.
Yes.
The sort of sense of, well, everyone's got something, that Rosebud, I suppose, in a Citizen Kane sense, but there's something from childhood that sometimes you feel, unless you attend to it, nurture it, you know, you may be satisfied in your life, but there's always going to be a little bit part missing. So the question is, do you at some point then aim for that dream to be realised, or do you just think, you know, I'm happy with my lot, you know, and that it's that intersection, I find, almost that liminal space of kind of feeling that you can carry on doing the things that you've been doing for years and years, or you can step outside of that bubble, or, you know, and but is it ever too late to do that, and would you regret doing that, you know, and that's part of the excitement. You don't know what the future holds, but you kind of know that there is something out there that sort of has got your name on it.
Yes. I think often if you look at people and where they are, you will find a thread of what they most want to do in life there somewhere. And, you know, in Jungian therapy, we would say that you have an individuation where there is time when the person that you have become because of circumstances, and this might be airy-fairy language, but forgive me, but the sort of the essence of you or the spirit of you or the soul maybe even, needs some expression. So, you know, if you've gone along being in a career that hasn't addressed you as an artist or you as a DJ or you're on the radio or, you know, in my own case, I guess, you know, I've gone a little bit sideways where I went into psychotherapy and I went into being taken much more seriously, and I was very involved politically with big changes that happened in therapy. I feel very honoured to be around that time in the 80s when we were changing the face of therapy, because, you know, I was a working class woman that was saying, I have a voice too, you know, and actually traditional therapy doesn't always meet that. And we had anti-discriminatory therapies that we were looking at. Is this the voice of non-white European and people with different sexuality and different identities? So I was very lucky to have been around all that, and that was very exciting. But I think now, the older I get, I'm being drawn back to that thread of meaning and purpose. And, you know, that we have a choice about cultivating happiness, and we have a choice about going back to which the heart most longs.
And is it something very different to, say, what your parents did or parents would have expected you to do?
Absolutely. I can remember my father in the early days saying to people, she's a drama therapist, I don't really know what that is. And, you know, my mother was a very pragmatic nurse. She was a nurse because in the Second World War, you didn't have to pay to become a nurse. And she said she had the choice of being in the land army or being in the nurse at 17, 18. And she was terrified of mice. So she didn't want to be in the land army. So she was lucky enough to have a career as a nurse. And my father would have been a philosopher of types. But he was a prisoner of war in Japan and was very, very severely disabled for most of our lives, and had nightmares and trauma. And probably trying to understand, you know, what was PTSD that wasn't identified then, probably sent me on this route. But no, I didn't know that was called therapy.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
No, and I think even to this day, sometimes people are surprised, you know, sometimes that the word therapy or the word counselling, you know, has all sorts of connotations about, oh, you must be a very broken sort of person. Yes. But actually, I think we all need something. Mm. And we always have a go-to person often, or there's something, or something that we sort of know where, you know, we need advice, or we need someone just to give us a bit of a steer.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think, you know, often, you know, I mean, I love Woody Allen films, and of course you often have the sort of the parody of the couch and the person, although I did actually do an interview with for this series, somebody who was lying down while he was doing the interview by choice, and I was thinking, this, you know, this was a film, you know, this would be a wonderful scene. But you know, lots of sort of baggage that comes with it. But in reality, I think everybody probably needs sometimes that question, you know, who are you? What do you need? Are you happy with the way things are going? Or is there an alternative with lots to unpack along the way?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. You know, in being a therapist, you have to be in therapy for years. So I had years and years of therapy. And I'm not in it now, but I would like to be.
Yeah.
I really love having that space to reflect, you know.
Yeah, and I realised that, and it probably struck me a few years ago, that people might know me for, you know, the things I have to do professionally. I have to write books, you know, that is the job.
Mm.
But I realised that I write a lot more, but nobody ever reads it. And in that sense, I wonder, in the last few years, part of me thinks, well, that's not going to change. But it's almost a way of sort of opening myself up, disseminating myself a bit more, and doing it with a certain confidence rather than the worry of, oh, what will somebody think?
Yes.
Or will somebody think I'm asking all these questions? And that, you know, because my parents, for example, would never do an interview like this, and they would be horrified if ever a picture of them turned up on social media. But that's because they've never been on social media, and they have an idea of what it could do, and how that, you know, it might almost like expose them in some way. Like, you know, suddenly people will know where they live, but that's not going to happen.
Mm.
But it is interesting how sometimes, you know, even in the days, you say, when people didn't know what therapy was, or people didn't go to counselling, there would have been maybe a family member or a confidant of some sort who kind of fulfilled that role.
Or maybe the vicar or the priest or the wise woman. You know, if we go back and back, there was always somebody that knew how to, well, hopefully knew how to just be still and give kind of like real presence and attention.
Yeah.
And that's still the key issues. You know, I've been teaching different kinds of therapy for over 25 years now.
Yeah.
And actually, when you come down to it, the core is always, are you listening with a good level of attention?
Yeah.
You know, and are you really present for that other person in front of you?
Yeah.
And I think that's the bit that makes the transformation or the healing or the ability to reflect much more than any technique we can
And seeing the fruits of that, that's a very sort of William Jamesian, but that sort of the fruits of that change, that transformation, it makes it all the worthwhile, because you see people on a journey and they don't know, and you don't know whether that journey, you know, where that journey is going to be, what the destination is. Or maybe you know what the destination is, but you don't know if they're on the right train, to reach that. But I think that, but part of the, you know, being part of that process, that it's the same with doing a degree, isn't it? That you can do a degree to get a certificate. You're probably not going to enjoy the degree very much if that's why you're there.
Yeah.
But if you actually immerse yourself so much into the material that you're studying, then you can, you know, one person I interviewed actually said that she forgot she was like doing a degree, but she loved it so much.
Yes.
She forgot that, you know, at the end of it, you get a certificate, because it's like, oh, I don't want it to end. I've started this journey. You know, it's a lifelong journey.
Yeah,
it shouldn't
passion,
be constrained.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
But
considering we've just been talking about therapy and counselling, my next question was about earliest memories and childhood. But you know, but do you have any particular sort of memory, any sort of drivers from any particular things that stand out, and you think, you know, maybe has or has not defined you? Because I didn't ask where you grew up.
I grew up in Dover.
Oh.
I grew up in Dover. I suppose there's a couple of things. I was aware quite early on, because my father had nightmares.
Mm.
I was aware of wanting to do something. He was a very funny man. He didn't carry it. He didn't put it upon us, but I was aware of that. So that would have been one driver. And, you know, I kind of loved stories.
Mm.
Always loved and lived through stories a lot of the time.
Mm.
And had a very, very... I can remember that we had a room, I think it was probably the outside loo that we had in those days, that had little black and white square tiles.
Mm.
And I can vividly remember I would go and sit in there, not get to the loo, just because I loved the tiles.
Yeah.
And I had different people in different tiles, and I would just story tell.
Yeah.
And I could stay in the cold for hours. Mm-hmm. That's kind of sticks in my mind. And I think my father would tell us stories. And there was a particular story he told, because I had imaginary friends. Mm-hmm. And it mm-hmm. was about fairies at the bottom of the garden. Yeah. Yeah. And I think the best part of that story was you couldn't go on the ferry train unless you were good.
Yeah.
And the heroine of the story was never that good.
Yeah.
And then he said at the end, but she was a child, so she could go anyway.
Mm. It sounds like that is the Christmas story all over, isn't it? Because that's what, you know, every year, that sense of if you've been good,
someone
might give you presents.
Yes.
But it's that sort of sense of feeling that maybe you're not good enough, but you don't want to be one of the bad people.
Yes.
So you can change, or you can just hope that you get away with it a little bit. You know, but that's, I mean, one of my daughters, I said on Christmas Day a few years ago, I said, if you continue to be a bit naughty, because she was being very naughty,
yes.
I said, you know, because Father Christmas might come and take away your present. I probably shouldn't have said that.
We'll do the best we can.
No.
Yeah.
And then, but what she said, she said, when will he come? And I said, what do you mean? She said, you know, when is he going to come to take the presents? And I said, oh, I don't know. 3 o'clock. She said, but how's he going to come? There isn't a chimney. And I suddenly realised, she's got me.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, she knows full well. A, I'm not going to carry this through. And she also, you know, I thought, she was about 4 at the time. I thought, you're smarter than me. And I thought, I can't continue this now. You know, so I thought, yeah.
And I think that is the core, this thing that I often find in therapy, that we so many people carry a core that they're not worthy.
Yeah.
Or they feel shameful, that they have to prove something to be worthy. You know, I think it's something we have around kind of in the West and Christianity, that we don't have this belief that we can make mistakes, but we're still innocent and pure and worthy and absolutely lovable inside. And that when you reach that point with working with somebody that, you know, it's okay to make mistakes.
Yeah.
We all do it.
Yeah.
We all have moments in our behaviour where we wish we hadn't been like that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't take away our kind of worthiness.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of like, I think there's a story about the Dalai Lama when he's talking. I probably haven't got this completely right, so I may have changed it in my mind. But he's talking to some of the neuroscientists and the mindfulness people, and, you know, they meet every 4 years for a conference. And he was hearing about the big trouble we have in the West is low self-esteem and low self-worth, self-hate. And he couldn't quite understand it. So he got his translator to translate it for him. And when he realised that he had understood it, the story that I remember, which might not be the same, was that he had a tear come down his eye and say, you know, that in the East there may be real external poverty, but nobody would believe that in the seed of their being wasn't the potential of Buddhahood or the potential of worthiness and good.
Yeah.
But in the West, this idea of original sin, that you have to prove yourself worthy.
Absolutely.
Whether it comes out in, you know, whether you're lovable enough to be in relationships or to have friendships, or you have to get her first.
Yeah.
It's really damaging to people's psyches.
No, that sense of guilt, and I think it carries through, you're right, in relationships, but also just in that sense, you know, I'm sure it's also what made me end up doing a degree in theology, that fear of hell. You know, in the 19th century, reading George Eliot, and, you know, these questions were so prescient for me when I was 16, 17. But also that sort of that Victorian crisis of faith, often I think we all sort of have on, you know, in one way or another. But in a Western context, you're right, this fear of sin, or that somebody, whether there's a God or isn't a God, but somebody's going to judge you. Maybe you'll judge yourself, but someone's going to come after you. Somebody's going to find
you'll
you
out. You'll be caught out.
Yeah.
You'll be caught out. You know, that there's a fatal flaw within you, or that, you know, we all know about this imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
I can remember with my son, because I tried to bring him up so that the idea of, if he was going to think about a God, it would be about grace. You know, that it was all about, ultimately, about love. And he grew up in Walthamstow, where there wasn't one faith. So he knew as much about Islam, probably more than he did about Christianity.
Yeah.
But, you know, I told him that if there was a God, there was nothing to be afraid of.
Mm.
That they would only ever want the best for you, and for you to find the way to find the best in you.
Yeah.
And then I took him at about 6. We went to the Vatican.
Yeah.
And he looked up in the ceiling and he said, why did you lie? Because the pictures of people being beheaded.
Yeah.
And he was almost traumatised by my lie. that if you look at this representation of God, or it's all about battles and beheaded and Moses, he was distraught with Moses.
No, because there's the narrative. You're absolutely right. I mean, the whole story, the Christian story, that yes, it's about love, but also you read the book of Revelation, you see it's about war and battles, and the end of the world, and you know. And I think that this is in all religions, but also in every person's life, there is this juxtaposition of often binary forces.
Yes.
You know, we often, you know, on a day-to-day basis have to deal with all sorts of, you know, struggles. Yes. Sometimes we create them for ourselves, other times they're imposed on us.
Yes.
And sometimes we need to channel them. And that's the thing, because I've always kept a diary. But, you know, a need to sort of have a way of almost saying, in my own voice rather than somebody else's voice, you know, what's this all about?
Absolutely. I think that coming back and finding your own voice is fundamental, isn't it? It's like the hero's journey, which hasn't changed.
Yeah.
That Joseph Campbell hero's journey is that's what it means to be human.
Yeah.
It's about how do you live this life the best you can, and how do we get out of the way those blocks.
No, I think you're right, because I go to the cinema a ridiculous amount. And yet, often in Dover, actually, which is why, you know, I pay £18 a month, and I see as many films as I like. And but the thing is, every story, well, virtually, has this hero's journey motif.
Yes.
And I think this sort of, and of course, I'm watching that thinking, but I never get enough, I'm never, you know, satisfied. It's always, I come back for more, because I'm often looking at those films and thinking, oh, this is mirroring my life. And I sometimes think, you know, that could almost be my life out there, you know. And sometimes I think, oh, maybe I should write my own screenplay, you know.
But
people think that cinema is a passive experience. Far from it. You might be sitting in one seat, although I never sit still, so I'm always, you know, moving around and sort of, you know, engaging with what I'm watching, and in some cases, you know, looking at with my hands covering my face. But there is something about the journey that every film sort of takes you on.
Yes.
Well, not all of them, obviously, because that's why... I mean, the worst film is often not a film that's badly made, but a film that leaves you very cold and you feel that you don't engage with anything that's happening on the screen. But you're right, the hero, the Joseph Campbell story, is utterly timeless, is utterly universal.
Yeah. And it comes back, and there's something about, you know, the film is probably our modern-day storytelling, isn't it? It's how we kind of... It's almost like the Greek tragedy, you know, you go through a bit of catharsis by seeing what somebody else is going through.
And reading that into our lives. But for me, I mean, film was something I discovered at university, and I was telling you before we started, Taxi Driver at the age of 17, and, you know, perhaps they shouldn't have shown it, but it had a lifelong influence.
Yes.
But it was music for me growing up. It was the charts, the sort of, you know, sharing in the playground with friends what was number one in the charts.
Did
that have an impact on you? Was music a big thing when you were growing up?
It was. It was, because, of course, you had Top of the Pops, and you had, you know, on a Sunday night, was it?
Yeah.
Where you'd have all that. Absolutely, yes. Yeah. I did. And, you know, I can see the kind of eras, because I was brought up around a lot of... My parents had all the records of the musicals.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I kind of, like, had a... So I kind of have that. That's almost embodied within me. You know, I can sing all the musical numbers from childhood. And
the charts, the top 40.
And Ed Stewart, who you talk a lot about, you know, on a Sunday, listening to that while you're having Sunday lunch or preparing Sunday lunch.
Junior Choice.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that, there's no doubt, and I sometimes I've joked to people, but I don't think I'm joking, that even when I'm lecturing, I feel I'm channeling something of...
Yeah.
Because there are lecturers who've inspired me, and often people, in terms of the content, obviously as I'm teaching, I think, oh, this person taught me this 25 years ago. That's obvious. But the actual mode of delivery, I have no doubt that Tony Blackburn, Ed Stewart, listening to them on the radio, the way that they had me hooked every week, and I'd be listening to them for hours, and there was something in the way that the excitement that they even... Well, obviously, Ed Stewart sadly passed away, but the excitement that they bring to what they're doing. And you feel, and often, in some cases, politically, I find that some of these figures are quite right-wing, and they're very different to myself. So I don't know what they're like in their personal lives, but certainly their professional work was so engaging, and it felt so real, felt so authentic.
Yes.
It felt that they... That, you know, even if they weren't paid for doing this, they would still want to turn up and deliver this, and that was huge in my upbringing. So Junior Choice was big for you.
It was around there. Radio 2 was on all the time in the background. You know, with the Archers.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was Radio 4 then, or where the Archers
were. It depends on it was. Yeah, because Radio... Yes, because you had the light programme. Yes, because you had Children's Hour in the 50s and 60s with Uncle Mac, and then Radio 1 and 2 broadcast. So in 67. Leslie Crowther actually was the first host,
Leslie
and then
Crowther.
Edward took over in 68.
My goodness,
I know.
Yeah, of course.
Yes. I just remember the tail end of that because Ed Stewart finished in 1980, and I remember. You remember Winifred School Choir and There's No One Quite Like Grandma, which was number one around the time that John Lennon died. And so it was a surreal moment where John Lennon had two number ones posthumously, and then Roxy Music had the number one with Jealous Guy. But in between that was There's No One Quite Like Grandma, which is a Junior Choice favourite. And yet that, you know, at that time, that was the biggest selling record over Christmas in 1980. So there is something about that.
It?
So yeah. People often to this day will sometimes think, oh, who could listen to that sort of music? But I say, well, there is a period. It's often it's sacred time, Christmas morning particularly now, because that's the only place you're going to get that music.
Yes.
You can have Ernie,
Sparky's
Magic Piano. And you've got 2 hours of that, and for me that is for me, you know, Eliade talks of sacred time. Well, Junior Choice, with sadly no longer with Ed Stewart, but completely said something about my childhood and utterly started me on this whole nostalgia journey.
Absolutely, I can see that. Yeah. I can see that. It did feel like you were being spoken to.
Yeah, and any particular records that you remember buying?
I can remember being given my first record player. And I don't know when that, but I was given The Sound of Music, and I love Motown.
Yeah.
And I had, it was The Supremes, The Second That Emotion.
Yeah. Ooh,
who was it? Yeah.
We know Smokey Robinson.
Yeah. I had that one, and I had a lot of Motown. I love Motown. Yeah, so I was around there, and then T-Rex, and, you know, and then I got into being a bit more soulful. I liked Gilbert O'Sullivan.
Nothing
old. You know, it was kind of a bit of poetry, wasn't it? It was something that came out there.
Because there's that bizarre line in there about something that seems completely incongruous, about the Napoleon Shandy, isn't it?
Bonaparte
Shandy.
Yep.
And but I always felt with his, and I think Graham Norton's actually interviewing him this Saturday.
Oh, really?
But he's a recluse, because for long periods Gilbert O'Sullivan would just disappear off the scene, but then he'll come back and then disappear again. So what if, you know? But his lyrics, sort of, some of them just seem to make no sense at all.
Yeah.
But you want to go back and think that there's something in this that's caught me. But I don't know what it is, and maybe I never will.
Yeah.
You know.
But I think that's kind of the whole kind of thing, isn't it? Something like that with American Pie as well, which I didn't understand all of it. When I said drove the Chevy to the levee, I had no idea what I was talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there was something about it. Wasn't that it made sense. It was that I understood it on another level. Yeah. It was the kind of meaning between the words. It was the kind of right hemisphere.
Yeah.
Oh, I get this, and I don't know why. Yeah. And that I'm really moved by that. Yeah. And I think that went on for me to go to Joni Mitchell.
Yes.
And, you know, that I was very hooked for a long time with those kind of things. And the feel of reggae that was so exciting because it was a whole body kind of feeling. Yeah.
Oh, no, absolutely. Early 80s, I was only about 7 or 8, but Bad Manners and Madness.
Oh, yeah, yes,
and this
yes.
sort of Buster Blood Festival. This was, and this was sort of like, what is this? You know,
yes.
is it a comedy? Of course, it was a great comic performance, but it was also, and the specials and Ghost Town.
Yes,
also
yes.
said something important about society under Thatcher in that era.
Yes.
And it was even apparent then, because, you know, we all thought Ghost Town, when at school, in primary school, we all thought Ghost Town was literally about something that happens when you go to the theme park. But really, of course, it's really talking about what's happened to the inner cities. And of course we didn't quite get that at that age, but you know, in later years we realized that it was a number one, wasn't it, in the summer as well of 81.
Yes.
Suddenly like, what is this music? And it's sort of like, suddenly this music has feel, and it's evoking something
and it was a political protest, which was really exciting, because I was around when Thatcher first came in, and I was at the Edinburgh Festival. We did something where, you know, in our naivety or whatever, we improvised a play around the similarities to Hitler. We might be going back as we are in this moment in time. And I carry some optimism about now, because I remember that during the Thatcher years, because I was out there and we were doing kind of either political theatre or therapy, that we got more funding than we ever got because the dissenting voice was heard. And I just have the secret hope that that might happen again now.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
Yeah, and that's something, and I don't know if that was something that even when you were a student you were aware of, but, you know, certainly a decade ago I would say that students didn't seem to be very politically engaged.
No.
Whereas students who, mature students I've taught who were perhaps students in the 60s or 70s would say that students in those days were very active. Oh, but now absolutely. It's gone full circle.
It has gone. Yeah. I was always on marches. Yeah. You know, I was always on a march. It was wonderful to be around about there. Yeah. Yeah, we were very politically active, very.
Yeah, and I was thinking of the 2017 election here, seeing all the students on this very campus queuing up outside. I didn't even know there was a polling station on Senate, because I'm sure I'd walked past on other election days, but on this day, the students were queuing up. And of course, we had a different outcome in... I wasn't a Canterbury elector, but I was aware that no doubt the student vote made a huge difference to the representation of Canterbury. And it's only thought
wonderful.
Politics does make a difference.
Yeah,
and
you it's can wonderful.
Really, it was very palpable.
And just hearing you say that, you know, I can feel I'm having a reaction of yes, you know. And I do... You know, in my position, I'm lucky enough both in the mindfulness that I do and in the individual work that I do. Yeah. We have some extraordinary young people, and they're thinking of a future way beyond the paradigms of how I feel the world could get better. Yeah. You know, which I find gives me a great deal of hope.
Yeah. And we should talk about mindfulness, because of course I studied mindfulness. Well, I say maybe studied isn't the right word. I practice mindfulness. I even have my certificate from last summer. But yeah, I mean, I felt I was always doing it wrong, because I was always I couldn't always get rid of some of the negative thoughts, but there was something about the space and lying down and sort of thinking, this is my chance just to think, okay, let me work out where I need to go, and almost to sort of deal with those negative thoughts, and to do so in a space where that was encouraged and where it was okay to do that.
There is no right or wrong with mindfulness. Yeah. I'm always going to say that one, aren't I?
Yeah.
And you're doing mindfulness if you're noticing your thoughts.
Yeah.
And we just begin to be aware of how driven we are by the thoughts, rather than, you know, that they... A lot about what we talked about earlier, you know, what is it that are our drivers, and it's often the thoughts that... are repetitious or habitual and negative, go round and round, and all we're trying to do is say, could we step back a bit to see that thoughts are not facts, and they're a little neural firing, they're not an absolute.
Because when I did that, because I've even got the yoga mat is also in the corner of my office, but I put that up on Facebook, when the mat in my previous office, and the reaction I got from people, I mean, a few people were sort of saying, oh, it's not for them at all, but loads who were really intrigued and also really excited that in a university setting, this is being taken very seriously. It's an accredited course.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people were asking me what was the reading material, because it was the audio book that I'd listened to.
Yes.
And but it really had a reaction. And, you know, people were very excited that mindfulness was being taken seriously, because they'd used it in different contexts, both personally and professionally.
Yeah. I'm passionate about mindfulness, and I discovered it about 12 years ago. And for me, I had these dual lives where I was a therapist and I was a meditator, because I'm a seeker. You know, I was born, I've kind of gone, I call myself a spiritual whore, because I think I've tried. I lived in London for nearly 35 years. I tried everything to say, where will I come home? You know, and I'd find bits I like, and I didn't like the dogma that went with it. But meditation was always a way that I had coped with the trauma that I was listening to that I couldn't erase. So that was really exciting for me when I found this thing called mindfulness, which was a combination of psychology and ancient traditions. And I think the word mindfulness is unfortunate, because the word mindfulness belongs to Buddhism.
Yeah.
And you know, it's about the road to enlightenment, but the in mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is what I do, it's about how to kind of really understand the patterns in which we kind of have been caught up, and how we can live more easeful lives and kind of not be manage our reactions that we have in our bodies, our automatic pilot reactions.
Yeah, no, and I found that. Isn't it good sometimes just to have the chance to do that sort of reflection? Because I think I'm somebody who's, and there's a positive in this as well, but you know, I've often been in the same place for many, many years. I was, I went to university at the age of 18 and I stayed there for over a decade.
Yes.
And there are many pluses in that, but it shows on, you know, that sort of staying power.
Yes.
But on the other hand, sometimes you think, but you know, was that just the safe option? Because whenever I've not done safe option, you know, with something you have to take risks. Sometimes you think, oh, it's worked out.
Yes.
It was the right thing to do.
Yes.
But actually making that leap is the hard part.
Yeah.
But mindfulness is also part of that process of saying you are an individual. You are allowed to sort of, you know, work out what your journey is rather than necessarily have it prescribed.
Absolutely. Mm. And giving you the tools. So if you want to make that leap, we can, mindfulness can help us go towards difficulty or fear without becoming consumed by it. Yeah. I mean, of all the therapy I've done, of all the teaching I've done about therapy, of everything, mindfulness changed my life more than anything else because it gave me courage.
Yeah.
It gave me courage to go towards things and feelings and thoughts that I was afraid of. And I think mindfulness also gives you the ability to say, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. I can stay in one place if I want to.
Yeah.
Some of our greatest writers and, you know, or people who have changed our world have stayed in one place.
Yeah.
You know, the adventure of the nearby is absolutely, I don't know who's, I've stolen that from somebody, but.
No, you're right though, because that sense of sometimes having the world come to you, you know, often, you know, there are different types of journeys. There's the one when you go the spiritual seeker, you can literally travel around the world, immerse yourself in different cultures, trying to find out who you are, where you belong. But also you can be in an office, you can be in one place, but kind of feel that you're still engaging with the world, often virtually, but often certainly a senior tutor, you know, there's not a single day when there aren't, you know, I don't think there's ever been a day when I haven't had some form of engagement or interaction with other people.
Yes.
Sometimes very fixed and, you know, through meetings that have been arranged in advance. Other times just because you need to go out and mix. And, you know, even if it's in the cinema, you're still around other people. So there's that sense of being part of a kind of community, albeit a community where nobody talks to each other, but you're all there for the same purpose.
Yes.
And that sort of, and there is something very edifying about that.
Oh, there's wonderful about that. It's like coming together, isn't it? Yeah. It's like a ritual.
Yeah.
I remember reading somewhere, and I can't remember where I read it from, and this is the wrong place to say something that you don't know where it comes from, because I might have made it up, and I wouldn't have an idea where they got the research. But the idea that when birds flock together and they go in, you know, they kind of the swirling, or when shoals of fishes go together, that when we are together, whether it's a football fan or whether we're in a cathedral singing, we have a similar electrical current between our brain's going on.
Yeah.
I'd love if somebody could back that up. Yeah. You might be listening.
Well, we will.
But interesting, I was thinking, it just came to me when we were talking about the kind of being nearby. One of the big influences of music when I must have been about 10, 9, is my sister, who was a lot older than me, had this Indian Hindu chant music, Govinda Jaya Jaya, probably that she'd been given somewhere. And that went straight into me. I loved that music. Mm. And for some reason, it seemed to resonate somewhere, and I had no idea why.
Yeah.
And it's been really interesting that all through the years, my go-to music will be Indian chants when I need to kind of be still, or I need to see hope.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, and now there's a lot more. I really like Krishna Das and people like that. That I find it very soothing and a sense of homecoming, which, that was, I didn't get that from Junior Joyce.
No, well, no, and I'm very aware that in some cases, it's only because I teach religious studies, but I have a very sort of, not even eclectic, very niche area of music, but also one that I feel I'm occupying, my generation particularly, because that's not the norm. You know, people, I mean, I did grow up with the charts in the 80s and the music of that period, but there's also a big part of me that wants to go back to my parents' generation, the music that they listened to,
and that
sort of juxtaposition. But my music is very, sadly, very sort of Western-oriented, really, and I you know, sometimes think that's a bit of a shame, but that's kind of what's defined me.
And that's what was available at the time. You know, it's just like it took me to get into my 20s, 30s before I understood classical music and knew how much I love Bach and how much, you know, I don't know. It's another one of those. I don't know why. There's something.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because some people, I know, Annie Nightingale would always say that, you know, she's always into new music and new experiences. And that's why she's still on Radio 1. She's pushing 80, and yet, you know, she's still.
Oh, she's pushing 80?
I think she was born in 1940.
Wow.
And I think that she is still on Radio 1, isn't she, like in the early hours of the morning? But she's playing lots of sort of new music.
Yes.
But I sort of went the other way. I'm somebody who will listen to all the old nostalgia type programs, Pick of the Pops.
Yeah.
But it's not just, you know, it's also quality proof that the music from that era that I grew up with, it's irrelevant whether it's good music or not.
Yes.
The fact is, it defined me.
Yes.
And I still listen to all this on in some ways on a constant loop.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I can see that. Because I would go in and out of John Peel.
Yeah.
I love that. And sometimes it was just, it it was to, I didn't have anywhere to latch it to in my head. So there, at times I would find that a bit dysregulating and I'd have to go back to something that was incredibly familiar. So I could listen to that and get soothed.
And some more philosophically based questions as we start to wrap up. Lorraine, would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you survey the whole of your life and career?
I do, actually. That's an interesting question. You know, I think I've been in and analysed so many of my difficult ones that I can still get hooked into them. I can still... But I have them more with a sense of melancholy rather than that they're predominant in their sad or fearful presentation like they used to be in the past. And I feel over the last years, I feel... I used to carry a lot of shame about my behaviour before I knew better, you know, about how to manage behaviour. And I've become much more compassionate towards my younger self. And like everybody, I've had difficult things happen in my life. Probably those difficult things that drew me to my profession and understanding.
Well, I was about to ask whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. In my case, absolutely. Not in a sort of those were good days, but more about the skills that you acquire when dealing with those situations.
Absolutely. And I can really see how they formed me. And I can remember when I was about, because, you know, I can remember going through a lot, what the students go through now, of just really intrusive thoughts and really negative thoughts and really sort of feeling overwhelmed by feelings. And that definitely, if I had not gone into going into psychology as a psychotherapist, I probably would have been in a hospital. I would have been in it one way or another. And I kind of almost worked through my issues myself by studying it. And not that I'm completely sussed by any means. But no, I really can see how those negative experiences and memories have formed me in a positive way. And I'm grateful. And but I do predominantly think I have... good memories.
It just made me think, because when I was very young, I remember watching an EastEnders episode where one of the characters had had some trauma. Kathy was the character, and she was training to be a counsellor. And at the time, it was sort of thought, but how could she be a counsellor? Because she's had all these things, unresolved things in her life, and sort of like. But of course, that's the reason why somebody can be a good counsellor, because they've. And at that, when I was very, I was about like 11 or 12 at the time. I thought, but counsellors have to be people who've got their lives sorted. And then I realised years later, it's like, well, if anybody ever thinks they've got their lives sorted, why would you want to go to them for advice?
Exactly. I think what you need to know is that, you know, the training, the long training and the therapy you have to do is so that you kind of understand how those things affect you, so you don't bring them into your work, that you can notice it without being driven by them. But also, absolutely, it helps me. I really do get, you know, I hope I get, but I'm really with the students I remember sort of like, probably 16 to 20s being really difficult time for me inside my own head. Which is why when we were talking earlier and talking about the books like To the Lighthouse and Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea made me realise that it's okay to be a little bit complex.
Well, better to be that, because that was a quote that came up, I remember, when I was doing my research years ago, about, it was in relation to Hitchcock and Catholicism. It said that the rank black sinner is closer to redemptive grace than somebody who just goes through life without thinking a thought and never did anything wrong, because they're not particularly attuned to, or actually that their life has not actually been particularly colourful, or there isn't much by way of character building. So I think it's often those extremes that can make you sort of realize, you know, you know the depths, you know how low you can go and how high you can strive, and therefore it's that somewhere you're able to see that and therefore perhaps relate to other people. Because if you're somebody who's sort of got no, you know, life experience, then probably you're not going to be the most useful of teachers or counselors in that respect.
And having seen that and in some way explored it, and also knowing that we're never actually over it, I don't think we always have to manage ourselves. And my ways of managing it is by doing mindfulness to make sure that I come back to that strong core within myself. And whereas you do your diaries at night, I'd have to journal in the morning to know where I am, who I am, what I'm thinking.
And I think having those non-negotiable parts of yourself, and I was only thinking earlier, like with these interviews, they take up so much of my time with all the editing, but I was thinking, that is so me that that's not stopping. You know, whatever yes. happens, that it's not a case of or if something else. You know, and every 9 days a new one goes out. And I think having that sort of structure, I think also has also made me realise, you know, what my passion is. And I think that then seeps into other things that I do, because yes. without being aware of it, people often say, "Oh, you seem to be really busy." And I think, yes. "Oh, I always worry people. I think, God, he just goes to the cinema every night." Yes. But actually, I realise that people perhaps see other things that I don't always pick up in myself, or they can see the journey that a person has been on, and they have a different take on that, both from their own apprehension of both experience of whatever's happened in their life, and also based on, you know, what the person is telling them about themselves.
Yes, and I think if you do have a drive and you do want to express something in the world, or, you know, with you trying to grapple with this extraordinary power of nostalgia, yeah. for good and for bad, you know, if we want to do anything, we have to be structured.
Yeah,
it doesn't just happen.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. No,
it's like all good art, creativity or art, where you make a difference. You need a structure.
Yeah, in the same way, who'd want a life where you're always being bailed out? You know, that's one of the stories, you know, in the Book of Judges, or, you know, sort of God will, you know, intervene. God will save you every time you do something wrong. You sin, God protects you and rescues you. But, you know, there are all sorts of questions there about sometimes we need also to do it for ourselves rather than have an external figure doing that. A few more questions, one of which I touched on earlier, but whether you, you know, have fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young, the whole sort of, you know, whether your 5-year or 15-year-old self, what they would think about what you're doing now, that whole sense of have you done what you sort of set out to do, or do you still have dreams?
Have I done what I set out to do? I don't think I ever knew what I set out to do. I wanted connection. And yeah, I feel pretty satisfied. I think I've been really lucky to be a woman that was young in the early 80s, late 70s, and I think I trod a path that women before me hadn't had the ability to do. I think had I been a generation four, I never would have got higher education.
Yeah.
I think we had grants in those days, and I was able to get into therapy. Yeah, I feel quite satisfied. Of course, I still have dreams. Yeah. There's a storyteller in me that really wants the opportunity to have the time and the place to explore that a bit more.
Yeah.
You know, I have a best friend that I met at 18, and we used to write stories together, and she's quite a well-known writer now.
And
I sort of, I go, okay, I went the healing journey, but have I quite, you know, there's still a bit of me that has a dream of that.
But it's true, isn't it? Because I see it now, because having done the reunion circuit, you know, often, that you can see that some people have fulfilled, or people doing things that you never thought they would do. Maybe they never thought they would do.
Yes.
But you also, I think one of my biggest flaws in my life has been to try or to define myself in the light of someone else. It's almost like, you know, a classic example was outside an exam room at the age of 21 for one of my degree papers. And a mature student, as it happened, who said, I'm really apprehensive about this exam. I only did like 14 hours of revision yesterday. And I'm thinking, I didn't do 14 hours. I'm going to fail. What's the point of me even going in? And then I think I got a better mark than she did. But this is the thing. For somebody else to define you to that extent, you know, isn't healthy. Sometimes you just think, you know, and I feel I'm at a stage in my life now, it's almost like, well, you know, eccentric, whatever it is, just do it,
just
go
be
there
it.
And then people often say, that's fine, we know where we are now, rather than that sense of, we don't know who you are, because you're always somebody who is letting somebody else's narrative determine the course that they take.
I think the one thing that I have stayed with me, and a couple of years ago I did some research around aging and mindfulness, and I got to interview some really, really old mindfulness teachers that were still doing it in their 80s, 90s. And one of them said to me, well, from the point of view of mindfulness, the best is always yet to come. And it was that idea that you could manage yourself and that you could be so present in the world, this might sound really numby, that you could just be aware of the joy of the moment. And I think that has become more and more. And having worked with quite a few people as they're dying and in the dying process, I suppose what I really want to do as I get older is to be as present as I can be in this world and with the people around me, to really be with it rather than caught up in thoughts or anxiety, and to be able to be present up until the end.
Absolutely. And are you in touch with friends from your past?
I am.
Yeah.
Yes, I am. And not huge amounts from my school years. I have more from my university or polytechnic years. And I have best friends. I have a couple of them. So I missed about 17, 18 in my Virginia Woolf years, as I call them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I met them through a joint passion for moments of being. That I'm in very regular contact with.
And I have this vision now of you all sort of going to a lighthouse and sort of, you know, having your reunion visits in a sort of very Virginia Woolf type environment.
I think we kind of hope that at some point as we get older we can sit there and knit and just watch the sunset. Yeah. And
but isn't that the great joy of life, that, you know, you can go on a big journey. A student of mine once said he went to the Leaning Tower of Pisa and he was so underwhelmed. The highlight of the day was sitting in a coffee shop afterwards and just sitting and looking out the window and just thinking, phew, thank God I got away from that throng.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, the Patronus moments, as I call them, from Harry Potter, those moments that kind of make us feel alive and make us feel most authentically who we are often the simplest. And it's just, I think, the more you kind of look for those, the more they become more and more of your life. So just the sunsets and the moments of connection, but not great philosophical moments.
Absolutely. And my very last question, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I think I'm a looking forward.
Yeah. Although very much present based as well.
I think I think you've just answered that for me. I don't think I do look that much forward. Of course I plan, but I kind of really want to be right here right now if I can. And of course I do look back. I don't know. I think I'm try to be as present as I can, but I do look forward to things. I do look forward, not to that I'm going to, this is going to be different or I'm going towards here, but just how much more delicious life could be, you know, if you have more time to practice and more time to stop being ambitious, I think. And really lap up the life. You know, I've got a dog who's aging. And the moments when I can just sit with her, like, she really didn't want me to come to work today. And it's like I can feel myself just wanting to just sit and look at the garden with her.
Well, I'm going to give
you...
Well, I'll give you that opportunity right now. No, Lorraine, it has been so amazing to catch up with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Lovely. Thank you for those questions.